thank you all very much. And Russ, I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. I don't deserve it, but I sure enjoyed it. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to just take a moment aside from what I was going to say to second Russ's opening remarks about the importance of what is coming up. I would also like to tell you in return that while Russ Walton is here representing one of our fine volunteer groups in California, UROC, I think every Republican, as a matter of fact, every Californian, could be very grateful that we have him on our side, because this is a knowledgeable and a dedicated and a fine man, and I can't tell you how much I respect his knowledge of the situation that confronts us. You know, I don't know whether the campaign didn't stop the last time or whether it's starting early, but I don't seem to have been out of this kind of a world for some time. To those of you who are out in the park today, I told someone there it's been a kind of a surprising and a new world to me, and a wondrous world in many ways. And I related a little incident about George Murphy that he told me when he finished campaigning. He told me that a little woman came up to him, took him by the hands and said, "Oh, I remember you when you were George Murphy." And then he said she told him with an equally sweet smile that she thought his speech was simply superfluous. Murph had figured he'd have a little fun, so Murph said to her, "Well, thank you, ma'am. I'm thinking of having it published posthumously." And she topped him. She smiled just as sweetly and said, "I can hardly wait." You know, I've just come down from San Francisco and meeting in some of the smoke-filled rooms, and they're a little different than the way they've been portrayed in literature in the past. I, of course, was a little surprised in reading the paper to learn how long the governor has been absent and spending his time in Washington. I didn't know that he'd allow Jesse Unruh alone in the office that long. It's wonderful, though, to see that the party in power is so concerned with the voting rights bill. And I think that's wonderful. And I also think that it's very typical, having made it safe for tombstones and warehouses and empty lots to vote down through the years, it's about time they turned their attention to people. I was in Washington some time ago and went down Pennsylvania Avenue. It was just getting twilight, and it was wonderful. The lights all came on in the White House now that the election is over. He has to turn the lights on. It's the only way he can see to read those Republican campaign speeches and find out what to do next in Vietnam. But seriously, a well-known historian has told us that when the freedom the Athenians wished for most was freedom from responsibility, Athens ceased to be free and was never free again. And continuing with history, about 100 years ago, an English lord, Lord Macaulay, wrote a letter to an American friend. And he told him that in the 5th century AD, ancient Rome was fearfully plundered by the Vandals and Huns. He said in the middle 20th century, and that's the approximate period we're in, he said, "Your republic will be fearfully plundered. But with this difference, Rome's barbarians came from without. Your barbarians will have been engendered by your own democratic institutions." Now, perhaps what he had in mind was what another well-known historian has said, Professor Alexander Fraser Tytler. And this historian said that democracy can't exist as a permanent form of government. It's kind of a shocking sentiment. He said that democracy can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. And from that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over a loose fiscal policy, always to be followed by a dictatorship. Unfortunately, we can't argue with Professor Tytler, because when he said that, we were colonials of Great Britain. And he was explaining again what had destroyed the Athenian Republic more than 2,000 years ago. The French philosopher de Tocqueville, and this was also almost 100 years ago, said the end of freedom comes when the party in power learns it can perpetuate itself through taxation. Well, what does happen to freedom when the executive branch can use the money taken from the people in order to coerce the people? 4.5 years ago, we were told, let us begin. And more recently, let's get moving. Well, we began at a new frontier, and now we're face to face with a great society. And along the way, we've added $30 billion to our debt. We've decreased our gold holdings to the point that there's concern for the solvency of our currency. And now we're told that we're going to have money that's something like a streetcar token, that it'll no longer contain anything of metallic value. We've discovered that every family in our land with an income of less than $3,000 is poverty-stricken. And yet we at the same time discover that every family's share of government expense is $3,300. The farmer's net income has dropped, but their debt in relation to income has reached an all-time high, even higher than it was on the eve of the Depression in 1929. $2.86 the farmer owes for every dollar of net income he has coming in. Crime rate is up 30%, and so is the rate of business failures. And 4.5 years ago, there were no daily casualty lists. No wives and mothers were receiving telegrams that began, "We regret to inform you." In the last campaign, our opponents presented themselves as conservatives. They actually presented themselves as conservatives in the sense that if they were returned to office, there'd be no upheaval, no drastic change, that things would go along in a kind of a prosperous and easy way that we were accustomed to. And on the other hand, in other words, they would maintain the status quo. That's Latin for the mess we're in. We, on the other hand, were portrayed as some kind of dangerous radical, and if we were put into office, we'd bring about some cataclysmic upheaval. Well, now the wraps are off the great society. A multitude of messages have made it plain that we're to have the welfare state with an unprecedented federalization of American life. Professor Teitler's loose fiscal policy is at hand. We're spending $260 million a day in the federal government alone. That's $10 million a day more than we were spending just 1 year ago. And as of last June 30th, Congress raised the debt limit for the fifth time in 4 years. Here in California, we've just been handed the biggest budget, a $4 billion budget, bigger than any of the other 50 states and the biggest in our history. We're told that it's a bare bones budget. Well, we know whose bones are bare. 2 years ago, when it was $3.25 billion, it was called austerity. Last year, when it reached 3 2/3 billions, the governor said it was frugal. It took California 100 years to come to a $1 billion budget. It only took us 9 years to double that, and it's only taken 5 years to double it again. And you wonder if we're supposed to try for 8. We're among the top in 10 industrial states. California is number one in the combined state and local tax, $420 for every man, woman, and child in our state. We're told that all this is due to the increase in population. Now, no one denies that as population increases, the workload grows bigger, and that proportionately we have to add to government's functions and services. But during the period when California has doubled its population, our state spending has gone up 10 times as much. Since this administration took office in Sacramento in 1959, our income, yours and mine, has gone up an average of 11%. But personal income tax collections have gone up in California 143%. Property tax has gone up 41%. They've reduced the personal exemptions. They've increased the franchise tax to business. And the emergencies that have come along with these swollen budgets have been met not by tax reform, not by some sensible permanent policy, but by one-time tax windfalls just to tide them over till another year, such as eliminating the installment collection of personal and corporate income taxes, Now we're faced with a deficit again with this $4 billion budget, and the same stopgap is suggested, this time in connection with the sales tax. The truth is, government's like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. Because of our willingness to accept our responsibility for those less fortunate, welfare has offered the government the greatest opportunity for growth. There's serious discussion today by learned men, supposedly learned men, toward the idea of divorcing entirely work from income, toward accepting the idea that actually we should take care from some central authority of people's, not only people's needs, but people's wants, whether they work or not. To quote de Tocqueville again, he warned that such a government would cover the face of society with a network of small, complicated rules, minute and uniform. Thus will the will of man is not shattered, but softened and guided until man is reduced to a flock of timid and industrious animals of which government is the shepherd. Well, can anyone deny that our limited government with its decentralized powers has given way to planners? And these planners have laid an increasingly heavy hand in every facet of our lives. The president is fond of quoting from the scriptures, 1 Isaiah, the 18th verse, "Come, let us reason together." Now that has an inviting, almost a cozy sound. Come, let us reason together. But let your eyes stray down a line or two into the next verse or two, where he doesn't quote, at least aloud, "If ye refuse, ye shall be devoured by the sword." Freedom is very fragile, and man has only known a few moments in all his history of freedom, and most of those moments have been ours here in this country. But freedom is also indivisible. It isn't spelled with an S. You can't elect to be partly free. Either you're free or you're not free. Now there are those among us whose concern for all who lack in material benefits would prompt them to sacrifice without any restraint our rights and our freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution. Indeed, they would declare and have so expressed themselves the Constitution itself outmoded in the interest of providing security. Now, I don't challenge their right to be heard as long as they are honest and don't lead others to believe that we can have both the great society and our inalienable rights, because we can't. For every measure of security that we try to buy, we must pay for it with another one of our individual freedoms. If we ever decide we need a new Declaration of Independence, I hope we'll keep one line from the old one. That's that line that says, "He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance." Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own. And in the case of California, that isn't easy, because we've added 50,000 employees in just the last few years. Government-owned corporations at the federal level. Government-owned corporations compete with private business and in so doing have lost $81 billion, more than a fourth of our national debt. The average businessman has 2,700 forms a year to fill out for the government. It has been estimated that it takes 35% of a businessman's time just to do government paperwork. And it has also been estimated that this paperwork costs American industry in total $20 billion a year, and then we're taxed for an additional $7 billion to handle the government's end of keeping track of all that paper. And as the government network spreads, they declare a war on poverty. Now, to getting the program passed, I'm sure we're all aware that West Virginia became the greatest argument for adopting the poverty program. This became a household word. In matter of fact, the argument about West Virginia being so poverty-stricken and such a center of unemployment was so common that you could almost believe that the entire war on poverty was going to be fought right there in West Virginia. And now we have the program. West Virginia receives $400,000. Texas receives $10 million. That's only a coincidence, of course. Maybe we need some target practice, or maybe we need indoctrination so that we can find out just where is the enemy that we're trying to lick in this war on poverty. Gum Springs, Virginia has been granted $74,000. $54,000 for administrative salaries and $20,000 for the poor. And the mayor of Paterson, New Jersey's all upset because he's just discovered that the director of the poverty program in Paterson gets $1,000 a year more than he gets. Well, I don't know, maybe West Virginia was lucky. 2 years ago, the Area Redevelopment Agency set out to help West Virginia. In one area, they decided that a furniture factory was just what the area needed. Now, they didn't bother to check on whether there was any market for the product or not. That wasn't important. They built this factory, it would provide 100 jobs. So the Area Redevelopment Agency put up almost $2 million. They poured in another $1 million of federal aid. They persuaded the West Virginia Industrial Development Authority to add about $134,000. The local banks came in for $75,000, and then they talked the citizens of the area into contributing out of their savings or investing another $220,000 in stock. It closed a few months ago. No jobs, no product, no profits, and if anyone wants a fine new office or a factory building, it's there for sale and they can get a tax write-off at the same time. No one would disagree with the humanitarian goal in the poverty program of helping those young people in the youth portion, the young people who through, or for whatever reason, have failed to meet their responsibility in fitting themselves for adult life. But down in Los Angeles, a part of this in salvaging operation for young girls has been set up in a 13-story hotel building they've taken over. And they're going to spend $7,000 a year on each young lady that is taken in to this training program. There are any number of American families that are fine, productive citizens and raising their families and educating them on incomes of less than $7,000 a year for the whole family. Young men who are participating in this program are paid more than the young man is paid who puts on a uniform and goes out to defend his country, and there's something pretty ridiculous in that. A congressman just shocked his fellow congressman with a story last week on the floor of Congress. His story had to do with two boys from his district, brothers. One of the brothers, a high school graduate, is in Vietnam, in uniform, getting $78 a month. The other brother, a dropout, was arrested for beating their mother, and he's getting $200 a month for running a power mower in the poverty program. Now, I'm sure that all of us are agreed. We have a moral responsibility to provide shelter for those who, through no fault of their own, lack adequate housing. Now we've passed a bill in which we're going to subsidize the rent so that people can live in houses and neighborhoods above their own means. And the bill is so drawn up that actually people with incomes in excess of $10,000 a year can find themselves eligible for this rent subsidy. The traditional laws of eminent domain in this country that protected the rights of private property did recognize that occasionally a government would find it necessary to take some individual's private property upon fair payment and for a purpose that could be clearly and definitely established as in public interest. And each individual citizen had a day in court to contest and forced the government to prove that this was true. Now a variety of programs of the federal government have so diluted private property rights that public interest is anything a few planners decide it should be. Urban renewal was created in 1949 to quickly provide decent homes for every American and eliminate slums. Again, no one quarrels with that purpose. But in a 10-year period, urban renewal destroyed 126,000 low-rent housing units and at the same time only replaced them with 28,000 at a higher rent. And almost 1 million citizens so displaced found dwelling and shelter in new slums paying a higher rent. In the meantime, in that same 10-year period, just by contrast, the private building industry in this country was building 27 million dwelling units. Now the law, the Urban Renewal Program, says the displaced must be offered standard housing at rents they can afford in convenient locations. But if standard housing in convenient locations at rent they could afford had been available in the first place, they wouldn't have waited for urban renewal to move out of the slums. Robert Weaver, the Federal Housing Commissioner, has stated that the government of the United States in the beginning gave the people the control of the use of the land to speed its development. And now, Mr. Weaver says, it shall be the policy of the government to seek to regain complete control of the use of that land. Planes equipped with surveying instruments fly over American farms and survey them to see if there are violations of their crop planting allotments. And if there are, they are fined without a day in court. Guilty as charged. And if they can't pay the fine, their property is seized and sold at auction. And this has been done in hundreds of cases in our country so far. For every dollar that in 1948 we spent on the price stabilization program and the Farm Bill, we're today spending $25. And with what result? Well, the farmer's getting 37 cents out of the market basket dollar. This is the lowest proportion he has ever received in the history of our nation. 2 million farmers have been driven from the soil to search for jobs in the cities. And the federal government tells us that 2.5 million more should go, that there's no place for them or need for them on the farm. Last year, farm expenditures were up $200,000, but farm income was down by a like amount. With one voice, government tells us that the small farm is uneconomical, that it must leave the scene. But with another voice, they insist on maintaining the 160-acre limit size for farms that are getting irrigation water. And now we have the incident of government arrogance down in the Imperial Valley. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with the situation, that here was a private irrigation district, and some 30-odd years ago, the federal government asked permission to join in them, with them in that private irrigation district. And in return for so doing, the federal government exempted the property owners there from the 160-acre limitation. There is a signed contract to this effect, but the people in the Imperial Valley have just been notified that as of January 1st, they will reduce to 160 acres, contract or no contract. And no voice in Sacramento has been raised in behalf of the citizens of California in this regard. Just as no voice was raised in Sacramento with regard to the ridiculous decision that canceled the Bracero program. We've seen an example here of a state administration that's more concerned with being a little brother to Big Brother in Washington than protecting the welfare of its own citizens. In the face of evidence presented by the most responsible people in the farm economy, not only in California but in other farm states, they went ahead with this program. And they may well have brought ruin to a $3.5 billion industry in California. During the last campaign, I'm sure we can all recall how a candidate for the United States Senate, George Murphy, warned over and over again of what would follow if this was put into effect. But he was told, we heard a voice from the State House say that he didn't know what he was talking about. He was trying to scare the people. And now that same voice is saying, someone misinformed me. And we learn of falsification of job placement records in the Farm Labor Office. And several employees have left hurriedly and resigned. And canning companies of some of the best trademarks are establishing plants across the border in Mexico. Banks have altered their policy with regard to crop loans. And the issue is, the issue spreads, and it's like dominoes going down one after the other. Because now it's not just a problem here in the San Joaquin Valley or in the Salinas Valley or the Imperial Valley. Now the problem is right in the breadbasket, and it's right out at the market where the housewife finds she's paying the highest price in all history for foodstuffs. Meanwhile, the network of rules grows more minute. You know that there's an oil station down on the Mason-Dixon line on a highway where many of the tourists from the north, when they're visiting the south, pass by. And this is an enterprising fellow running this oil station. He had a little triangle of ground between the sidewalk and the driveway. Usually people have that, you know, in that kind of business, they cover it with gravel, not him. He planted a few cotton bushes in there. And when his northern tourists came down and stopped for gas, as an inducement to stop, he gave them a cotton bowl picked from one of these bushes that they could take as a souvenir. The federal government has just fined him for planting cotton without an allotment. In the meantime, the Secretary of Labor, hearing the pleas from the farmers, comes to California and stalks through our fields. While up in Sacramento, they cower there and hope that he'll turn out to be a jolly green giant. Well, he turned out to be something less than that. Are we safe in our books and records? The post office has just admitted that they have been taking mail addressed to people who are back or delinquent in their income taxes and turning it over to the Internal Revenue Service. And recently the Treasury Department has been forced to admit the use of wiretapping and bugging devices in automobiles and homes, spying on people with regard to tax collections. Almost every county in California finds its welfare bill taking more than half of its total budget. Not too long ago, Tulare County admitted that welfare spending for the first 9 months of this year was double the total amount they had budgeted. Now, most of this is because of requirements. First of all, forced on the states by the federal government in connection with the grants of money, and then passed on by the states to the counties, where there's little or no power to put sensible rules and policies into practice. Do we think that we honestly can go on no longer teaching the simple virtues of reward for labor, or that we should pay back when we borrow? There's a small college town here in California and a Rotary Club. And this Rotary Club, in an effort, has a worthwhile project in an effort to help the college. This Rotary Club has a fund, and they lend money to needy students. No interest. And the students don't have to pay it back until after graduation. The other day, the dean of the college called the Rotary Club and said, if you're not willing to make this fund an outright gift, we won't need it anymore because the federal government's putting up the money and the students don't have to pay it back. And now our states find themselves creating culture bureaus because Washington is going to subsidize art and literature. We're going to have, if the plan goes through, two czars in Washington. And they will dole out millions of dollars on their opinion of what constitutes meaningful art and literature. Well, now, perhaps I'm unduly perturbed, but if we follow the pattern that the government has in some of its scientific research, there's reason for concern. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't pose as a scientist. I have little knowledge in the higher echelons of science. But I sometimes wonder if we aren't underwriting just plain intellectual curiosity when I see tens of thousands of dollars being spent on a program of research in philology and faunal affinities of fossil bryozoa in the Middle Ordovician through Silurian. Now, the only thing in that I understand is that phrase, in the middle. There I know who they're talking about. Now the nation's capital is going to concern itself with recreational facilities and our ability to enjoy ourselves in the great outdoors. There's a book. It's being put out. This book is being put out by the Special Engineering Services Branch of Environmental Engineering and Food Production of the United States Public Health Service. That's not the book. That's just the agency that's publishing it. There are 134 pages of profundities, and I don't know how we managed to get along without them up till now. For example, if you lay out a campsite, you should provide drinking fountains at such a height that the drinking level is convenient for the persons using the fountain. Now, wait till you get to the exciting chapters on wildlife. Insects crawling into outdoorsmen's ears sometimes create painful conditions. Well, I got news for them. It's no fun when it happens indoors. But that isn't all they have to say about wildlife. If your recreational area has a bathhouse intended for the use of both men and women, it should be divided into two parts by a tight partition. Now, you know we'd have never thought of that by ourselves. Inflation, planned and deliberate, has reduced the value of the dollar in less than three decades to 35.5 cents. In the last 20 years, according to the American Industrial Research, inflation alone, caused deliberately by our government, has eroded the value of your savings and insurance by $190 billion. We're taxed in our food and our drink and our shelter, with the government taking a higher percentage from the productive free economy than any society has ever done before without ruin. We're told that we'll have a $5 billion cut in the excise tax, but we're also only going to have a $3.5 billion deficit for the year just passed. That's less than anticipated, and so it is, but not because someone put into practice any economical measures. It's because of a bookkeeping trick that if it was practiced by a private businessman, he'd be jailed. What they really did was take some of this year's spending and put it back on last year's bill, so they've got an $8 billion deficit for last year, and someone else can get blamed for that. At the state level, of course, all the bills go up because of this policy, this created inflation. And so we wearily look around at the state and the local level to find sources for new revenue. But when you look at some of the plans that have been suggested in Sacramento, you find out that it isn't really tax reform, it's just the old shell game. They're going to rearrange it. They're going to transfer the tax from here to there and to somebody else and around, under the pretense that we're robbing Peter to pay Paul. Well, I think we'd better drop that pretense for and take another look. We're robbing Paul to pay Paul, and you and I are all named Paul, because Peter went bankrupt a long time ago under this practice. People pay taxes. To pretend that you can reduce taxes without reducing the burden that causes them is to perpetrate a fraud upon the people. Now, in an atmosphere of emergency, and with a great excessive zeal for our welfare, the federal government proposes to invade an area that has been the traditional province of the local community in the state, the finest public school system in all the world. At the same time, they deny that they intend any federal control with this federal aid. They deny every suggestion that is made for solving some of the financial problems by tax credits for the educational costs or remitting tax revenues to the states or the communities for their use without federal strings attached. The truth is, competent authority, capable educators and school administrators have gone to Washington and have testified before congressional committees that there are no problems that cannot be met at the local and state level. We've built $30 billion worth of classrooms in the last 10 years without federal help. We've reduced the ratio of pupils to classroom and the ratio of pupil to teacher. We've increased the average teacher's salary in 10 years, 65%. And we've increased our school revenue by 156%. And last year, the American voters approved the largest school bond issue in the nation's history. Nevertheless, as of right now, there are 135 separate offices and agencies in the federal government doling out money to colleges. And through the poverty program, at the opposite end of the spectrum, we're going to begin with the kindergarten. Of the two, I'm a lot happier and feel more confident in the government participating in finger painting and playing in a sandbox. When a group of college presidents, alarmed over the threat to academic freedom that is inherent in this federal handout to universities, proposed a plan whereby you and I could financially aid the colleges and universities without creating any government bureau or going through government as a middleman, a Freudian slip occurred. Francis Keppel, United States Director of Education, said to these college presidents, "You don't understand, under a plan such as yours," he said, "the government can't achieve its social objectives." Social objectives. But if the government is going to build the schools and buy the books and grant the scholarships and make judgments and exert pressures, what if someday those pressures are of a political nature not to our liking? Education is the bulwark of freedom. We've known that from the beginning of our nation's history. But you remove it too far from the community and the parents' control, and it becomes a tool of tyranny. 100 years ago, this nation faced a nation divided, half slave and half free, and a problem as to whether such a nation could survive. Today, the world is half slave and half free, and the question is whether mankind can survive. We call out to the guard in the night, "Does all go well?" And echoing back off the Potomac comes a voice, "There's nothing to fear." Nothing to fear but an evil enemy who, since World War II, has increased his enslavement from 8% of the world's population to almost 40%. Every lesson of history tells us that as nations have grown in culture and refinement, they have softened. And when confronted by the less cultured, the barbarians have triumphed. We have come to our moment of destiny. We can't meet the problems of a divided world or a divided nation with a splintered party. And now I speak not only to Republicans, but to Democrats. We as Republicans, I believe, do have a responsibility to mend this shattered party because our party is the vehicle that is still polarized around a belief in individual freedom and the right of a man to determine his own destiny. But I believe at the same time there are millions and millions of fine patriotic Democrats who have no intention of sacrificing their individual freedom for some false promise of material benefit or security. But to speak directly to the Republicans, who must take the lead in this because of the party philosophy, for a long time now, we've been Republicans complete with descriptive adjectives and hyphens: moderate Republicans, liberal Republicans, conservative Republicans. Well, I think those adjectives and those hyphens were given to us by our opponents, and it's time we bundled them up and gave them back. And if we have to use a hyphen at all, let's start being Republican Republicans. We can cringe in the shadow of a philosophy we detest but fear to challenge, or we can rise from the defeat we've just gone through and begin the second round of our battle to restore the republic. Let's be a party of opposition. Opposition to a misguided leadership at home, and opposition to all the evil abroad that threatens the dignity and freedom of man in every land. We can't do this by trying to outpromise our opponents. To those in our own midst who talk cynically of voter blocks and political expedience to win their support, I'd like to suggest there is a voter block for us to appeal to. It's a voter block that crosses party lines, racial lines, religious and ethnic lines. It's made up of a lot of unsung heroes, people who get up in the morning and send the kids to school and go to work, pay their bills, contribute to their church and their charity and their community. They believe that God is the creator of man and of all of his freedoms and rights, and they're disturbed because their children can't ask God's blessing on a lunch in the school cafeteria. There haven't been very many voices raised in their behalf in government. Well, I say that block can be ours for the taking. If we're willing to stand on principle, to stand on what we know in our hearts is right, if we're willing to tell those people that we too mean to solve the problems of hunger, of disease and poverty and destitution, but we believe we can do this without resorting to compulsion and fiscal irresponsibility. We believe that we can put a floor beneath which no citizen will be asked to live in degradation in this country. But at the same time, we repudiate the idea that there shall ever be a ceiling above our citizens. And we reaffirm our belief that every citizen has the right to fly as high and as far as his strength will take him without being penalized for his initiative and his energy and effort. And let us tell them that we will not buy our security from the threat of the bomb by trading away the freedoms of people in other lands that aren't ours to give. And I think we should tell these people that if their sons are to be asked to die for their country, at least at the same time we'll give them the chance to try for victory. Thomas Wolfe said, "To every man his chance. To every man, regardless of his birth, his shining golden opportunity. To every man the right to live, to work, to be himself, to become whatever his manhood and his vision can combine to make him. This is the promise of America." Well, an earlier generation of Americans pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to give us that promise and our freedom. And Americans since have paid with their lives and their fortunes, and all of them have preserved their honor. I'm sure that we pray every day devoutly, as they probably prayed, that we shall never be called upon to make such a sacrifice. But one thing is certain: if we aren't willing to make the same pledge they made and make it out loud within the hearing of the enemy, then freedom as we've known it will be lost in our lifetime. And our failure will be recorded in a book not yet written called The Rise and Fall of the United States of America. The pathway of history is littered with the bones of dead empires. If we're to follow in their course, we'll have no decades or centuries for leisurely decay. As the enemy at our gates is combat lean and hard and hungry for everything we've created. We and we alone, in this moment in time, must make a decision as to whether freedom will perish from the earth. And I think this is a time for every Republican to look deep in his own heart and ask himself if he can possibly have any difference with any other Republican that is more important than this challenge and this responsibility facing him. If he says there is, if any of us can fail in this challenge, then I think we'd better decide how we're going to tell our children and our children's children what it was that we found more precious than freedom, because they're going to want to know. Thank you.